This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Tomorrow, here at UNC, author Pat Conroy will receive the Thomas Wolfe Award, the prestigious honor named for the Asheville native and one of North Carolina's brightest literary lights. Like Thomas Wolfe, Pat Conroy has mined the events of his life in writing his books. Pat Conroy's characters have the feel of real people because they are based on them. The great Santini, brought to life by Robert Duvall in the movie of the same name, stemmed from Conroy's childhood with his abusive military father. Lords of Discipline was based on Conroy's life as a student at the Citadel. Prince of Tides, inspired by his sister's mental illness. Pat Conroy's seventh book, a nonfiction memoir, is now out in paperback. It's called My Losing Season and was set during his senior year as a basketball player at the Citadel, and it concludes that the losing record of the team that year prepared him for life in ways that winning might not have. Tomorrow, as we say, Pat Conroy will receive the Thomas Wolfe Award and give the Thomas Wolfe Lecture at Hill Hall on the campus of UNC Chapel Hill, but he joins us now here in the studio. Welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here, Melinda.
Well, Pat Conroy, you're here, as we've said, to get the Thomas Wolfe Award, and I understand he was a very important figure to you as a student and as a writer later.
He was the most important figure in my literary life. I discovered Thomas Wolfe when my high school English teacher, Gene Norris, gave me a copy of Lycoming Angel for Christmas when I was a junior in high school. And I remember reading the first page, and it electrified me. I was thunderstruck by language for the first time. And I started reading his story, and I identified with him so greatly because it was like he was writing my story.
Really?
And
I mean, what in particular?
Abusive father, miserly mother, rambunctious family. I read this in absolute amazement that he had lived through something that reminded me so much of what I was living through at that time.
Mm-hmm. So was it the similarity then in your childhoods, or was it, as you were saying a second ago, being thunderstruck by the writing?
I had never met up with a writer who could affect me viscerally and emotionally just by the way he wrote a sentence until I met Thomas Wolfe. This guy lived in his sentences. This guy bled in his sentences. This guy, I mean, it was so momentous, my picking that book up, it changed my whole life. And by the end of it, and I'm not alone in this, by the end of reading that book, I had decided to do what my mother had always wanted me to do, that I was going to try to be a writer, that I was going to try to write books.
And if he had written about something other than an abusive childhood, do you think that it would still have had the same impact on you in writing?
You know, I'm not sure about that. You know, it was the perfect book at the perfect time for a 16-year-old boy like me to get. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you can give us a selection here, an example of Thomas Wolfe, perhaps even the first page that so struck you.
I'll give you what first struck me when I was 16. A destiny that leads the English to the Dutch is strange enough, but one that leads from Epsom into Pennsylvania and thence into the hills that shut in Altamont, over the proud choral cry of the cock and the soft stone smile of an angel, is touched by that dark miracle of chance which makes new magic in a dusty world. Each of us is all the sums he has not counted. Subtract us into nakedness and night again, and you shall see begin in Crete 4,000 years ago the love that ended yesterday in Texas. The seed of our destruction will blossom in the desert. The election of our cure grows by the mountain rock, and our lives are haunted by a Georgia slattern, because a London cut purse went unhung. Each moment is the fruit of 40,000 years. The minute winning days, like flies, buzz home to death, and every moment is a window on all time. This is a moment, Melinda, and we are in it.
Mm-hmm. Pat Conroy reading from Look Homeward, Angel by Thomas Wolfe. Pat Conroy, the author, is here in Chapel Hill to receive the Thomas Wolfe Award tomorrow. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. So when you began writing in earnest, was Look Homeward, Angel the model? Was that something conscious that you tried to achieve?
Or? Yes. In fact, I have told people, Melinda, that the estate of Thomas Wolfe could have sued me for plagiarism for the next 10 years of my life, and they could have won every single time. Mm-hmm. My sister tortures me by bringing out stuff I wrote in high school, and it is so Wolfe-oriented and so Wolfe-influenced and so Wolfe-shaped that it is a particular embarrassment to me, but I was trying hard. I had an English teacher in college at the Citadel who said he would gladly shoot the professor who introduced me to Thomas Wolfe. So I have lived with Wolfe and his shadow for a long time.
Right. Now, how long did it take to shed that? Do you think that you
I don't think I've quite shed it yet. This is, you know, I still will carefully select a pretentious, overblown adjective when a very simple word will do, and I still blame Thomas Wolfe on that.
How about the idea of subject matter? I come back to this, the style versus what you're choosing to write about.
Lacombe Angel explained to me the life I was in the middle of leading. My father was, in Lacombe Angel, the father never beats his family. But living in the family I lived in, I knew the father was beating Thomas Wolfe and his family. It just wasn't, it was one of those subjects you could not write about then. And he could not go that far.
In the 1920s.
He could not make that betrayal. But that was one I was glad to make years later. I was very happy to say that my father was beating us and beating my mother. But I think what had opened the door for that was my association with Wolfe, because he almost gave me a roadmap of how I could live through that childhood, how I could survive it, and how I could even benefit by watching closely what these parents did.
Now, Thomas Wolfe, because of his writing, alienated a number of people back home in Asheville. And then his last book before he died was You Can't Go Home Again. He died at 37. And it was about a novelist who returns home to his hometown, and he's this pariah because he has done as Thomas Wolfe did. He's written about the town in a way that the folks there find unflattering, to put it delicately. You've run into that, too.
Oh, of course. You know, most writers run into that in some way or form. All the good ones do. And when I wrote, and here's the mistake I made, and why I was so stupid at this time of my life, I have no idea. I knew exactly what happened to Thomas Wolfe with Asheville and his family. And why, when I wrote The Great Santini, I did not make it an Eskimo family, and, you know, a group of Inuit tribesmen living on ice floes, I don't know. And I disguised it so little that my father's nickname in the Marine Corps was the Great Santini. I didn't put him in the Air Force, which I could have done. I put him in the Marine Corps. I put him in Beaufort, South Carolina. The mother was exactly as I saw my mother when I was growing up. She had a far more treacherous side that I did not get into until The Prince of Tides. But I knew what happened to Wolfe, but I walked in this with my eyes open. And the explosion that went through my family stunned me and startled me. And I asked myself, why am I surprised? Remember what happened to Thomas Wolfe. But I learned nothing from what happened to Thomas Wolfe.
This has been documented before, but just for our listeners now, I mean, folks were not talking to you for years in your
family. Well, the problem I was having was Mom and Dad were going through a divorce when the book arrives. And I had not had the courtesy to inform either one of them I was writing a book about their marriage and our family. So the book comes in. Dad is living in Atlanta. The book comes in. There's nothing I can do. He comes over to the house. He sees the book. He's stunned. And he says, son, this is the greatest day of my life. And I said, Dad, you may not agree with that after you read it. And he looked in the front. He said, my God, you dedicated your mother and to me. You named the book after me. I'll never have a day like this. And Dad goes home. I said, read it, Dad. And I know you move your lips and use your index finger, but I want you to read this book, your first novel. He calls me up after an hour. Why do you hate me, son? Keep reading, Dad. Just keep reading. He called up 2 hours later, sobbing. Then he disappears for 4 days. My grandmother calls up his mother and says, don't worry about your father. He's gone to commit suicide. And my grandparents never talked to me again.
Wow.
And I lost Dad's side of the family for many years. My grandmother, my mother's mother, calls up and says, I never saw anything like that go on in the family. You know, and I said, too bad, Stanny. You weren't there all the time. And so the full shockwave, you know, hit me. But in that, Dad came back. Dad heard what was happening. His family was calling me, cussing me. Dad came roaring back out, and he wrote a letter to all his family. And in the letter, he said, I have just read my oldest son's work of fiction. He underlined fiction about 70 times. And he says, what a vivid imagination that boy has. And he said, I like the portrait of the mother and the portrait of the sister, Mary Ann. But I want to tell everybody that my son was not good enough a writer to solve the complexities and subtleties of the great Santini himself. And with that letter, Dad and I began our long walk back toward each other. Mm. I had hated him with my body and soul for my entire life.
Yeah. And your mom, how was she with that? Because
okay, here's what mom did. My mother, the drama queen beyond anybody's imagination, takes the novel after she reads it, walks into the divorce court, hands the book to the judge, and says, my son wrote the whole story, Your Honor. It's all in there. There's no reason to call a single witness.
Wow. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pancava, and writer Pat Conroy is our guest today. His latest book, My Losing Season, has just appeared in paperback, and he is in Chapel Hill to receive the Thomas Wolfe Award tomorrow. We're taking your calls. If you have a comment or would like to ask Pat Conroy a question, our number is 1-877-962-9862. Well, Pat Conroy, we were talking just before the break about The Great Santini, which was the book based on your childhood and your abusive father. Don Conroy. The movie version was played by Don Conroy was played by Robert Duvall, and we have here a clip from a rather famous scene from that movie in which your father has lost a driveway basketball game to his teenage son, and the father reacts violently.
Wasn't that great?
Come on, Jocko, you gotta win by two baskets.
He said one.
I changed my mind. Let's go.
Now, you're not going to cheat the boy out of his victory. Come on, be a good sport.
Who the hell asked you anything?
Don't you talk to me like that.
I'll play him off.
No, you won't. Now, he beat you, and it was beautiful.
Lily, you better get in the house before I kick your butt.
It was just beautiful.
No, I mean it. Come on, let's go. Hurry, come on.
Just that ball.
You better move, woman.
All right.
Come on, let's go. Come on.
He beat you.
Get out of here.
Kind of like winning, huh, Dad?
Get smart with me, Jocko. Kick your butt. Now, come on, guard me. You got to win by two.
I'm not going to guard you, Dad.
Hey,
Mama's boy.
Mama's boy. I bet you're going to cry. Come on, Mama's boy. Let's see you cry. Come on. Squirt at you. Come on. Cry. Cry. Come on. Come on. Just a few. Come on. Squirt a few. Come on.
From The Great Santini, and that sound we're hearing at the end of the clip is the father bouncing the basketball off the son's head as the son walks up the stairs. He does it all the way into the house. The Great Santini is your father, Pat Conroy.
Yes. There's no question about it.
Did that scene happen? Did your dad bounce the basketball off the back?
No, I made that up. What Dad would do to me, we played basketball. Whenever we played, he would simply slap me in the face until I quit.
When you were starting to beat him?
No, I mean, I wasn't even starting to beat him before I even took my first dribble. He would slap me in the face until I quit. We never played together.
You never played?
No, he just would slap me, coach just slap me in the face. And so I never, never got to put the ball on the ground. But the humiliation that led to the invention of that scene in my head. Mm-hmm. But here's the nutty part, Melinda. I have brothers and sisters who claim they witnessed that scene. My father said that scene happened for the rest of his life. Fiction is strange because people start living it. I mean, people started coming back. My brothers have met 80 roommates I had in the Citadel.
And housing was not that precious there.
And I had a guy, I was at a signing, and I think it was in Raleigh, when Beach Music came out. And this woman says, my husband claims he roomed with you at the Citadel. So I see this young woman, she has two young kids, and I see this very young man with his back turned to me in shame, being exposed. So I jump up, I say, roomie, and the guy hugs me, and we embrace. He says, we got drunk every night. I didn't drink, was it? So, and we went out and got drunk. We walked tours together. I never walked a tour. So.
Yeah.
But there's some kind of association that goes on in readers' minds that make them feel that they have lived in these books. And I get this a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You joke about your father. I mean, there was anger and there was a vicious relationship that he had.
He was the worst father I have ever seen in my entire life. He was horrible.
Right. But then you just said a few minutes ago that after the book came out, the reconciliation began.
We had a long period of reconciliation. I did not forgive easily. Yeah. I forgave hard. And I put Dad through many hoops, but he jumped through every one of them. I think when the book came out, he was horrified that this was how his family looked at him. And he spent the rest of his life trying to prove that I was a liar and that he was a better man than I had written about.
Mm-hmm. But did he deny the facts that you stated in the book?
Yes, he did. He died as a denier. I mean, he never came clean about that. And I'd be lying to you if I told you he did, but he did not.
Okay. Let's go to Tammy, who joins us from Raleigh. Hi there, Tammy.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Welcome. Did you have a question for Pat Conroy?
Yes, I do.
Sure.
Thank you. Mr. Conroy, this is such a pleasure. I read Prince of Tides, loved it, went to see the movie, and it was nothing like I had read. And I felt gypped and somewhat violated. How do you deal with that?
I deal with it by them paying me millions of dollars. And I, you know, this is one thing that I wrote the first script. Then they fired me. And the reason they fired me, Tammy, I've always loved this. They fired me because I just didn't understand the novel. So you go through a lot with Hollywood, but they reward you well.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Thank you for taking my call. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Tammy. We go now to Alan, who is in Winston-Salem. Hi there, Alan.
Hey, good morning.
Hi there.
Afternoon, whichever it is.
Afternoon.
It's such an honor to talk to Mr. Conroy, and I do have a very quick question. I have never graduated college because I continue to fail composition classes. I just can't write an essay. How do you get started? What is your secret?
You can write an essay because you can speak a clear sentence. You've just spoken several to me. And write as you speak. You speak very well, sir, and you can get through them.
Well, thank you. It's just it's just frustrating as all get out to put these thoughts on paper.
Is there something you want to say?
That was my question.
No, I mean when you're writing, is there something that you want to say?
Well, not particularly. I mean, I just I enjoy reading great works, but I just cannot stand writing. I detest writing.
If I had felt this way you did, sir, I would not have eaten, and my family would not have eaten for all these many years.
Well, thank you for persisting because your books are delightful.
Great. Alan, thanks a lot, and good luck.
Oh, thank you.
Write us when
much.
You get work. Okay. Let's go to Kim and Carrie. Hi there, Kim.
Hi. This is such an honor, Mr. Conroy. You are my favorite author.
Obviously, you're a woman of great taste and imagination.
Exactly. I had the same feeling about Prince of Tides as the caller a while ago. That was a great disappointment because it shortchanged the book so much. But anyway, The Losing Season... was such a joy. I listened to it on an audio tape on the way to Florida last year, and I usually get very sleepy driving, but I made it all the way to Florida. So you saved us from running off the road. But on the way back, I made my husband listen to it, and he's not a great reader.
He's a male. I'm accustomed to this.
Absolutely. But I saw him. It was so funny. Through the whole book, he smiled and nodded, and he played basketball also and sat the bench a lot. And I think he really... everything that you said resonated with him, and I thought it was very interesting how you pointed out that losing was almost, in a way, better than winning, that you learn more from it. And in this day and age, it seems like we all, you know, we want our children to win at everything, and that perhaps they've learned more by losing.
Life will take care of your children winning. Don't worry about that.
That's right. I am amazed you made it through with everything you've been through, so congratulations on your newest honor, and... hope to see a lot more books.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kim, thanks for your call. Well, I did want to talk about My Losing Season, which is now out in paperback, your most recent book. And this was a memoir as opposed to something that you fictionalized.
Right.
Why'd you do that instead of making another piece of fiction?
Well, I wanted to get down. There were several reasons. I wanted to celebrate these players mm-hmm. that I had loved when I was in college.
And we should explain, I should take a step back and say this was your
senior year
at the Citadel on the basketball team.
So I thought it was going to be wonderful. I thought we were going to be terrific. And we stunk. And I, you know, thought about this on and off. I thought this year never left me. But I was in a bookstore in Dayton, Ohio, when I looked up in John DeBrost, the guy who played guard with me, was walking the bookstore looking uncomfortable. And I said, DeBross, you ever been in a bookstore before? He said, once, Conroy. I was lost. And he says, Conroy, my wife and kids don't believe I know you. Could you just please come home and let me introduce you to them? On the way there, I had a life-changing conversation. John and I were talking about that season, and we talked a lot about it, deeply. And then finally he says to me, do you remember the last game you ever played, Conroy? And I said, I certainly do, John. Do you remember how it ended, Conroy? And I said, I do, John, but I would never have brought it up to you because it must be painful to you. He missed a layup that would have won the game in the tournament against the University of Richmond. And John surprised me. He is not an emotional man. He's an Ohio man, a Midwestern man, not a Birkenstock kind of guy, not a Chapel Hill kind of guy. At the next stoplight, with great emotion, he grabs me by the wrist and he says, Conroy, I want you to know I didn't miss that shot on purpose. And I said, of course not, John. Everybody knows that about you. And he said, our coach thinks I missed that shot on purpose, so he would lose his job. And I said, I would have missed that shot on purpose. I thought Coach Thompson would have lost his job. Then John said to me, I think missing that shot partially ruined my life. And that was the beginning of this journey. I went back, found every player that I played with, asked them questions more than they'd ever answered, more than they wanted to know. Got every memory from him, put this book together. Mm-hmm. And it was a very emotional thing. And I also got to write about what Don Conroy was like when he was just Don Conroy. I wanted to get down what he did and how he did it to his wife and children.
You wrote in some places in My Losing Season that sports books are always about winning because winning is far more pleasurable and exhilarating to read about than losing. And then you say, loss is a fiercer, more uncompromising teacher, cold-hearted but clear-eyed in its understanding that life is more dilemma than game and more trial than free pass. And you say that prepared you for life.
I think it did.
What would have happened if you'd won?
You know, I don't know. You know, when I meet the guys who are champions now, and I met at the White House the other day. I got to introduce Bob Lanier, the great center, and Willis Reed was there, the great Nick, and his great stumbling hurt through the underbelly of Madison Square Garden to come out to guard Will Chamberlain. And every time I meet these legends, these winners of all, they seem sad to me. They seem, their glory days are gone. They can never recover them. Like me, they're aging, getting old. But there's nothing I'd look back on that I miss, like I think they do. The triumph and... I think it hurts you because it always happens when you're a young man and you have the rest of your life to lead, not being a winner, just being a man like everyone else.
I was wondering if you read for us a moment ago from the opening page of Thomas Wolfe, Look Homeward, Angel. Would you read from the opening page from My Losing Season?
I certainly will. There was a time in my life when I walked through the world known to myself and others as an athlete. It was part of my own definition of who I was and certainly the part I most respected. When I was a young man, I was well-built and agile and ready for the rough and tumble of games, and athletics provided the single outlet for a repressed and preternaturally shy boy to express himself in public. Games allowed me to introduce myself to people who had never heard me speak out loud, to earn their praise without uttering a single word. I lost myself in the beauty of sport and made my family proud while passing through the silent eye of the storm that was my childhood. Football and baseball were always secondary sports to me, and I played them to appease my father and because they were seasonal in nature. I tried out for baseball teams when farmers were planting cotton, and I was putting on a football helmet to run back punts when they were harvesting it. But I was a basketball player, pure and simple, and the majesty of that sweet sport defined and shaped my growing up. I cannot explain what the sport of basketball meant to me, but I have missed it more than anything else in my life since it issued me my walking papers and released me to live out my life as a voyeur and a fan. I was never a very good player, but the sport allowed me glimpses into the kind of man I was capable of becoming. I exulted in the pure physicality of that ceaseless, ever-moving sport, and when I found myself driving the lane beneath the hot lights amid the pure, electric boisterousness of crowds, humming and screaming as a backdrop to my passion, my chosen game, this love of my life, I was the happiest boy who ever lived.
Pat Conroy reading from the first page, the prologue of My Losing Season. So you didn't become a basketball star.
No,
I did not. You went on to become a writer.
I became a writer.
Right. And did have gone to heights in that field?
Well, you know, as far as I could go.
Yeah.
Just like I went as far as I could go as a basketball player. But I regret, my one great regret was I was in a tournament in Tampa, Florida. And if we could possibly, DeSoto could possibly have beaten Florida State, which was impossible, I would have played the great Dean Smith and the University of North Carolina. But we were eliminated in that first game.
A question here. You are touted in, people tell you in the book, your coach or other folks tell you that you had a lot of drive. You may not have had the pure talent, the gift for the game, but you went at it. You pulled out the stops.
I was one of those kids.
But you have a gift for writing. That did not come with any difficulty, did it?
Well, writing always comes, I think, with difficulty. It was.
But you're different from Alan, who called a little while ago.
I'm different from Alan. And I was raised by this mother who raised me to be a Southern writer, and with emphasis on the word Southern. And Mom, from the time I was born, her reading to me constantly as a kid, her dream for me was I would be a writer. And so this was put in my head quite early. I just didn't know how to pull it off.
You don't sound like a Southern writer, though.
You should not sound like a Southern writer. And I never could understand. My sisters and brothers sound like Gomer Pyle. And I could never figure out why I sounded like that robotic voice in the Atlanta air terminal that tell you, please move to the back of the car.
Of the people mover?
Yeah, the people mover.
Between the gates.
Yeah, I sounded just like that guy. And I never could figure it out until Dad was dying. And he said, hey, sports fans, you want to know the houses you lived in since you were born? I said, I'd love to, Dad. I have no idea. So Dad had this book he had in very neatly, his beautiful penmanship. It's funny, a brutal father with a beautiful penmanship. I could never figure that out. But he showed me all the houses I had lived in since I was born. And there were 23. We had moved 23 times by the time I was born until the time I went to the Citadel. And one of the moves was fascinating to me because I was born in Atlanta. I knew that. What I did not know is when I was 3 months old, we moved to California, where he was at El Toro, Station El Toro. I learned to talk in California, and that's why I have this ridiculous accent.
Pat Conroy is with us, the Southern author with, as he describes it, a non-Southern accent. We have Matt, who's in Chapel Hill. Hi there, Matt.
Hi.
Hi, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pat?
Yes?
Do you remember Lieutenant Barkley?
I'm sorry?
Do you remember Lieutenant Barkley?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, that's me.
How are you doing, Lieutenant?
Very good. It's been a long time.
It's been a really long time.
I'm going to tell the listeners, I had made a comment to you. I saw you on the basketball court once. I don't think I had watched many games. But I noticed how quick you were in guarding somebody coming down the court. And I had said to you, probably in ignorance, that you had, because I don't know if you already were playing football, but I said, you ought to be a defensive back on the football team. You're very quick.
Now I remember you very well, Lieutenant.
And and as I recall, you demurred. I don't remember what you said, but essentially it came down to, I don't want to do that, or I don't like getting hit, something of that effect.
The I don't like it here sounds very much like me.
Yeah.
I
couldn't blame you for that. I wasn't real keen on getting hit myself.
Well, that was, but I was on a basketball scholarship by then. They would not let us play football.
Ah, that was it. Okay.
Now, were you a fellow student at the Citadel or an instructor there, Matt?
No, I was his physics teacher. I was a freshman physics teacher.
How'd you do in physics?
I got a D-.
Oh, really?
I was so pleased that you gave me the D-.
Wow.
I cannot tell you. I thank you even today.
No kidding.
I was the worst student in physics in history.
Oh, no, you weren't. I remember a couple of others whose names I will not mention.
I was so happy when that D-minus came up, I could not even tell you even today.
Oh, really? Well, there was at least one guy who he was taking it for the second or third time. I should explain to everybody that this was a required course for non-physics majors. Everybody had to take
it. It was a nightmare.
And you had to do better than an F to get
yes,
to
F. Yes, F would have sent me back to the lieutenant.
No, it wouldn't have, because I was on a one-year appointment. I didn't even wear a uniform. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do remember that.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to say hello.
Thank you so much, Lieutenant.
I'm glad you're doing so well. And I guess I'm glad I didn't get to witness your losing season because I was there in 1964 and 65.
Well, great. Well, thank you for your call, Lieutenant.
Thank you. No, I'm just Matt Barkley. Don't worry.
Okay. Well, thank you, Matt.
I was then, though.
And you're listening to The State of Things. We are talking today with Pat Conroy, the author, most recently, of My Losing Season and the recipient tomorrow of the Thomas Wolfe Award here at UNC Chapel Hill. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-877-962-9862. You can also email us at sot@wunc.org. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pankova. We're talking this hour with writer Pat Conroy, who lives in South Carolina on Fripp Island, but he is in North Carolina in Chapel Hill right now to receive the annual Thomas Wolfe Prize that he will be receiving tomorrow at UNC Chapel Hill. We are also taking your calls this hour. The number is 1-877-962-9862, 1-877-962-9862. Email address is sot@wunc.org. I want to pick up a little bit about you writing My Losing Season. There is a passage in here where you say that Michael Jordan understands losing. You write that, I saw Michael Jordan play baseball and he understands coming up short physically.
He sure does. And he plays golf and he knows and I know that he cannot be a professional golfer. He could take up bowling and not be a professional bowling or tennis. And that is the one thing about athletes that I am perfectly or athletics, I'm perfectly sure about, is you learn humility. And even Michael Jordan learned humility when he went back as a 40-year-old man and was not the best in the NBA. I mean, he learned a lot last year, and he learned about losing.
Right. But I wonder if that's easy to say about the idea of losing for guys like Michael Jordan and yourself, who maybe came up short in a sport that you loved or liked, but you had somewhere else where you really excelled, Michael Jordan in basketball earlier in his life, you with writing. But what about other folks who don't get to those heights?
I find that life is very tough for everybody. Life has been much, I've had several great surprises in my life. Here are two of them. Life has been much tougher than I thought it was going to be. And I think that's true for everybody. I mean, I don't know about you, but it has thrown at me more than I can handle. It has thrown tragedy at me. I never factored in the fact I'd be there when my parents died. I never thought about divorce or anything I would go through or children, how terrified I am about the lives of my children or the direction they're headed. That was my first great surprise. Then the second great surprise is the swiftness of the passage of time. That has shocked me. And everybody, my grandmothers would always tell me that when I was young, but I didn't believe it. And they were strangely and savagely correct about that. And I'll be 58 this year. And some people listening to this will think, my God, a young man. Some people will be saying, my God, he's going to die soon. But it is the same for all of us. The swiftness is the same for all of us.
Do you feel like as though the time goes faster in your adult life?
There's
because
no question.
It seems like in our childhood, you cannot
remember
wait
looking
till
at the
next
clock, waiting for 3 o'clock. I remember just staring at the clock, thinking, "My God, a minute is an eternity," and "My God, when will this be over? I'm trapped here, and I'm trapped in this life." And now, it seems like a year passing seems like what a month passing was in my childhood.
Let's go to Mike in Chapel Hill. Hi there, Mike.
Hey, Pat. I'd like to ask you, why are you so forgiving of not just your father, but also the coach in My Losing Season? He was the reason for the season being so bad, but yet you defended him. And your father, like you take your father on the book tour when Santini came out, and I just don't understand how you could be so forgiving?
Well, I was raised by these men who were so relentlessly cruel. And, you know, the coach, that was the way guys coached back then. You know, I had coaches all during my childhood, and they were tough. They were just tough on you. They yelled at you. And I just don't think Mel Thompson meant anything by it. When I went to see him, you know, he seemed like a sad, older man to me. And I saw him. He seemed glad to see me. I interviewed him. He didn't remember a single thing to help me along with that season. And I had three guys on the team who could never forgive him, who hate his guts with their body and soul to this day. I'm not built like that. And I certainly found out that it was when my father, that I had been waiting all my life to have a father I could love. And though he was not perfect by any means, he gave me one at the end of his life. And the reason he did was because I wrote The Great Santini. But what I told Dad in The Great Santini, I said, Dad, I had to make up stuff you did that was nice in that book because no one believed you could be so horrible. And so I had you give your son a flight jacket. And Dad said, I gave you that flight jacket. I said, no, you didn't, Dad. You didn't give me anything. And you sent roses to your daughter at her first prom. You never did that. You never think of doing something like that. And in this, in the wrapping up and summation of my own life, is I don't want to be like those guys. I don't want to be relentlessly, aggressively, virilely male that cannot change, cannot admit mistakes. I just don't want that for myself. And if I can find in myself to forgive these guys, I let myself do it. And I found that I could.
Mm-hmm. You know, Thomas Wolfe, his last book was Can't Go Home Again. And it seems like you do go home a lot yourself.
I do.
Back home.
I want to go home.
You go home to that, your family. It comes up a lot with what you write about. And you're showing me I call it a gimme cap. It's not a gimme cap because I'm sure they didn't give it to you. It says the Citadel on it, baseball cap.
And
but you go back to those places.
You know, and in the Citadel, and I have buried the hatchet after 30 years. And I do go back, and I need to go back. And remember, you know, I was homeless. And, you know, my search for a home. One of the things that I identified with Thomas Wolfe in his life, his mother ran a boarding house. He had to find a bed every single night. He slept in a different bed. And I identified that, I think, in a unique way, because I was in another room every year of my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because of what you described before, your father saying that you were traveling from place to place. Cindy joins us now from Chapel Hill. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a real honor, number one, to get through. I figured I wouldn't have a chance today with Mr. Conroy being there. Really, I just have a comment. I think more than any other Southern writer in the last 20, 30, 40 years, he captures the essence and nuances of being Southern. And I really appreciated him giving some background today about the influence that his mom had on him becoming specifically a Southern writer. And I would just like to thank you for the books that you have written. I've read them all several times through and recommend them to friends and strangers. And I just thank you for your work, and I appreciate your time on the air.
It's always great to hear from my first cousin.
Cindy, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
You know, in Prince of Tides, you had a line that Tom Wingo talks about Southerners being heroic listeners and saying that they had the instinctive wisdom of knowing their place, being able to assess that instantly when they were over their heads.
Yes, I heard this the other night in Charlotte. I was speaking to a group, and I think it was honoring people who had given $10,000 to the United Way. And so I was asked to speak there, and the dress was casual. And it was a low country oyster roast. And so I know how to dress for that.
In Charlotte.
In Charlotte. Okay. So I dress for the low country oyster roast, and I walk in there, and I was blinded by the glitter of diamond bracelets and diamond necklaces. And, you know, the guys were dressed in these suits. Looked like they were made out of the foreskins of llamas. And I'm just looking around these. I mean, I've never seen such expensively dressed people. So when I got up, I said, hey, Charlotte, this is what casual looks like. I didn't realize I was walking into Charlotte casual with something else. And I instantly knew I was some of the richest men in North Carolina and married to the richest women. And I could see it just by walking to the door. Mm-hmm. I was bushwhacked by it.
Mm-hmm. And beyond that, did you, here you are, somebody who's celebrity, you're, well, let me step back on that. Not celebrity, but you've risen to the height in your field. Did you still feel awkward around that kind of
glitter? Yes, I certainly did. I always feel awkward. And my mother had a keen sense of social inferiority. And so my mother had a unique way of getting out of it. She came from, when I tell you my mother was from a redneck background, I want you to believe me. My mother was, so what she did, she married a Marine officer. And she simply lied the rest of her life about where she came from. And by the time she died, she was claiming that she had a degree from Agnes Scott in Atlanta, that we were descended from the largest plantation owner family in Alabama, and that we had plantations and grew cotton. And it was all just a lie, or at least I think it was a lie. But what I now think is my mother was the first fiction writer that ever came out of our family, and that she wrote her story before I wrote mine.
Now, is that what being a Southern writer is? Then?
Right.
Is that, no, truly, I mean, is that, I'm seriously asking, is that what, when your mom, you say your mom wanted you to be a Southern writer?
I think she willed me to be a writer.
Okay.
I think it was a
will. Who happened to be from the South?
And she was from the South, and Dad was from the North. He was from Chicago. So there was great geographical rivalry in that. The South is losers, Dad would say, you know. And Mom would rise up in the South's defense. And that was this little game that was played my whole childhood. Mom fought for the South, and all seven of her kids are fiercely, staunchly Southern.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Gene is with us from Raleigh. Hi there, Gene.
Hi there, Melinda. I want to certainly welcome Mr. Conroy to the Triangle.
Thank you, Gene.
Congratulate him on his award. But I'd like to express a bit of appreciation for a book that's not so often talked about. I have to admit to being a little behind. I haven't read Lords of Discipline and Losing Season yet, so I got some catching up to do.
I can tell you the whole plot, Gene. Don't worry about it.
Well, I'm a real fan of the Lowcountry area, which, of course, you write a lot about. And in that book, Lords of Discipline, which is, of course, is about the Citadel, that prologue in there, which is a portrayal of Charleston and Charleston society, is one of the most devastatingly accurate things I have ever seen about that place, and I just enjoyed reading it immensely.
Well, I'm glad you did. So you'll know there is a Thomas Wolfe in Lecumberland Angel also does a scene in Charleston, sets a scene in Charleston, and it was almost in homage to Thomas Wolfe that I wrote that prologue.
How? Well, I heard a story from a friend of ours once years ago who was visiting Charleston and said to this old grand dame, who was obviously from the right side of Broad Street, that he was eager to move to Charleston. And he thought when he got there, one of the first things he wanted to do was join the St. Cecilia Society. And she sort of drew herself up to her full 60-inch height and said, "Young man, it is obvious that you are clearly not to the manner born."
That's Charleston.
Absolutely. But enjoy all your books, and good to hear that you're here.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for your call, Gene. Speaking of Thomas Wolfe, you're going to be getting that award tomorrow here at UNC, the Thomas Wolfe Award. You're working on a script?
I've been working on a script for, I think, 10 years.
Look Homeward Angel.
Look Homeward Angel. And I'm going to go back to when I get back home and try to finish it up and send it out to him. But it's a work of love.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I'd love to see the thing come to the screen.
So you're doing this on spec, right?
Yeah,
I mean, you're just
right now
writing it. Okay. How have you done scripts other than the one that you started to do for Prince of Tides?
I've done lots of scripts. Doug Marlette and I wrote a script called X a couple years ago. And I got into it in that period of my life before I realized Hollywood would eat me alive if I stayed with it. And I wrote a script for The Prince of Tides. And I wrote a script, the first version of the script, for Beach Music. And then I said, enough. I could do this the rest of my life. Some of these people are horrible, carnivorous people, and I need to get back to writing the books I think I was born to write.
Mm-hmm. The Losing Season wouldn't have prepared you for Hollywood then?
My losing season did not prepare me for Hollywood. I was simply stunned by the ferocity of the people I met out there.
Really? In My Losing Season, you write that it was during that season that you decided, yeah, you're going to go and do what your mom had been grooming you for, and that was to become a writer. And we came up with something that we'd like to play.
Oh, no.
We'd like to play.
Okay.
You wrote about this in My Losing Season. Let's hear a little bit of this.
Okay. I haven't heard it since that night.
So set us up for this. This is.
It was after a baseball game at University of West Virginia, and we always traveled with these station wagons, and we were coming out of the hills of West Virginia, and we were by this beautiful river. And all the guys were asleep, and two songs came on. The one you just played, and Monday, Monday, by the Mamas and the Papas. Mm-hmm. The songs came on. And I was in kind of a reverie in the back seat. It was so beautiful. And this river was so beautiful. And the moon, when we were coming out of the mountains, and that is when I made a promise to myself that I was going to try to become a writer. Mm-hmm. Didn't know how to do it. Didn't know how to become one. Didn't know one, but I was going to do it.
Because you heard Sarah Vaughan singing?
It was so beautiful. And I haven't heard it since that night.
Is that right?
I haven't heard it.
Is that right?
And I wasn't sure it was Sarah Vaughan. You know, at that time in my life, I knew nothing about music. But I heard that song, and it was so achingly beautiful, followed immediately by the first time I ever heard Monday, Monday. And I said, okay, I've got to at least say I'm going to do it and see if I can do it. And I started calling myself a writer that night, and I never stopped.
Okay. Pat Conroy is with us, and I think we have time for at least one more call. Jordan joins us now from Chapel Hill. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm a teacher at a local independent school, and I teach a film class, and we are just studying the screenplay to The Great Santini and the transfer of the novel to the screen. And my question for Pat was, what decisions went into what stayed in the screenplay and what was cut from the novel? I know he's talked a little bit about how carnivorous Hollywood is, and we certainly have talked a little bit about that in my class, but I'm just curious as to about some of those decisions.
But that is a fabulous movie. I love that movie. And I got to tell you, kids, I got to see that movie with my father for the first time.
Uh-huh.
And my favorite scene in my entire life was when they were burying the great Santini. I look over, and there are tears rolling down my father's cheeks, moved to tears by his own demise. And I said, give me a break. Give me a break. The scene that did not make it in the movie that I would love to have been there is when they're coming into the town and the sister Marianne is catching her tears in a spoon and flinging them at the father. I would love for that scene to have been made the final cut. But I love that movie. And it's the only place in the world I can go to see my mother alive. They let her be in the scene during the basketball game. She's sitting directly behind Blythe Danner. And so we go back to when the family gets together, we turn that thing on and go right to that scene and just look at Mom being happy.
Right. Pat Conroy is our guest today on The State of Things. Was that your favorite movie adaptation?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, I really liked that movie. Mm-hmm. And it was magic. It was made in Beaufort. Mm-hmm. And filmed in Beaufort, the town I'd written about.
Pat Conroy has been our guest today on The State of Things. Thanks for being with us, and congratulations on the Thomas Wolfe Award.
Thank you for congratulating me. It was one of the great moments of my life.
Pat Conroy will be giving a public lecture tomorrow at 7:30 at Hill Hall at the UNC Chapel Hill campus. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Melinda Pencava. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We're talking this hour with writer Pat Conroy, who lives in South Carolina on Fripp Island, but he is in North Carolina in Chapel Hill right now to receive the annual Thomas Wolfe Prize that he will be receiving tomorrow at UNC Chapel Hill. We are also taking your calls this hour. The number is 1-877-962-9862, 1-877-962-9862. Email address is sot@wunc.org. I want to pick up a little bit about you writing My Losing Season. There is a passage in here where you say that Michael Jordan understands losing. You write that, I saw Michael Jordan play baseball, and he understands coming up short physically.
He sure does. And he plays golf, and he knows, and I know, that he cannot be a professional golfer. He could take up bowling and not be a professional bowling, or tennis. And that is the one thing about athletes that I am perfectly or athletics, I'm perfectly sure about, is you learn humility. And even Michael Jordan learned humility when he went back as a 40-year-old man and was not the best in the NBA. I mean, he learned a lot last mm-hmm. year, mm-hmm. and he learned about losing.
But I wonder if that's easy to say about the idea of losing for guys like Michael Jordan and yourself, who maybe came up short in the sport that you loved or liked, but you had somewhere else where you really excelled, Michael Jordan in basketball earlier in his life, you with writing. But what about what about other folks who don't get to those heights?
You know, I find that life is very tough for everybody. Life has been much... I've had several great surprises in my life. Here are two of them. Life has been much tougher than I thought it was going to be. And I think that's true for everybody. I mean, I don't know about you, but it has thrown at me more than I can handle. It has thrown tragedy at me. I never factored in the fact I'd be there when my parents died. I never thought about divorce or anything I would go through, or children, how terrified I am about, you know, the lives of my children or the direction they're headed. That was my first great surprise. Then the second great surprise is the swiftness of the passage of time. That has shocked me. And everybody, my grandmothers would always tell me that when I was young, but I didn't believe it. And they were strangely and savagely correct about that. Mm-hmm. And I'll be 58 this year. And some people listening to this will think, my God, a young man. Some people will be saying, my God, he's going to die soon. But it is the same for all of us. The swiftness is the same for all of us.
Do you feel like as though the time goes faster in your adult life?
There's
because
no question.
It seems like in our childhood, you cannot
wait. Remember looking
at the
clock, waiting for 3 o'clock? I remember just staring at the clock thinking, my God, a minute is an eternity. And my God, when will this be over? I'm trapped here and I'm trapped in this life. And now it seems like a year passing seems like what a month passing was in my childhood.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Mike in Chapel Hill. Hi there, Mike.
Pat. I'd like to ask you, why are you so forgiving of not just your father, but also the coach in my losing season? He was the reason for the season being so bad, but yet you defended him. And your father, like you take your father on the book tour when Santini came out, and I just don't understand how you could be so forgiving.
Well, I was raised by these men who were so relentlessly cruel, and you know the coach. That was the way guys coached back then. You know, I had coaches all during my childhood, and they were tough. They were just tough on you. They yelled at you, and I just don't think Mel Thompson meant anything by it. When I went to see him, you know, he seemed like a sad, older man to me. And I saw him. He seemed glad to see me. I interviewed him. He didn't remember a single thing to help me along with that season. And I had 3 guys on the team who could never forgive him, who hate his guts with their body and soul to this day. I'm not built like that. And I certainly found out that it was when my father, that I had been waiting all my life to have a father I could love. And though he was not perfect by any means, he gave me one at the end of his life. And the reason he did was because I wrote The Great Santini. But what I told Dad in The Great Santini, I said, Dad, I had to make up stuff you did that was nice in that book because no one believed you could be so horrible. And so I had you give your son a flight jacket. And Dad said, I gave you that flight jacket. I said, no, you didn't, Dad. You didn't give me anything. And you sent roses to your daughter at her first prom. You never did that. You never think of doing something like that. And in this, in the wrapping up and summation of my own life, is I don't want to be like those guys. I don't want to be relentlessly, aggressively, virilely male that cannot change, cannot admit mistakes. I just don't want that for myself. And if I can find it myself to forgive these guys, I let myself do it. And I found that I could.
Mm-hmm. You know, Thomas Wolfe, his last book was Can't Go Home Again. And it seems like you do go home a lot yourself.
I do.
Back home.
I want to go home.
You go home to that, your family, it comes up a lot with what you write about. And you're showing me I call it a gimme cap. It's not a gimme cap because I'm sure they didn't give it to you. It says the Citadel,
yes.
Baseball cap.
And
but you go back to those places.
You know, and in the Citadel, and I have buried the hatchet after 30 years. And I do go back, and I need to go back. And remember, you know, I was homeless. And, you know, my search for a home. One of the things that I identified with Thomas Wolfe in his life, his mother ran a boarding house. He had to find a bed every single night. He slept in a different bed. And I identified that, I think, in a unique way, because I was in another room every year of my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because of what you described before, your father saying that you were traveling from place to place. Cindy joins us now from Chapel Hill. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a real honor, number one, to get through. I figured I wouldn't have a chance today with Mr. Conroy being there. Really, I just have a comment. I think more than any other Southern writer in the last 20, 30, 40 years, he captures the essence and nuances of being Southern. And I really appreciated him giving some background today about the influence that his mom had on him becoming specifically a Southern writer. And I would just like to thank you for the books that you have written. I've read them all several times through and recommend them to friends and strangers. And I just thank you for your work, and I appreciate your time on the air.
It's always great to hear from my first cousin.
Cindy, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
You know, in Prince of Tides, you had a line that Tom Wingo talks about Southerners being heroic listeners, and saying that they had the instinctive wisdom of knowing their place, being able to assess that instantly when they were over their heads.
Yes, I heard this the other night in Charlotte. I was speaking to a group, and I think it was honoring people who had given $10,000 to the United Way. And so I was asked to speak there, and the dress was casual. And it was a low country oyster roast. So I know how to dress for that.
In Charlotte.
In Charlotte. Okay. So I dress for the low country oyster roast, and I walk in there, and I was blinded by the glitter of diamond bracelets and diamond necklaces, and you know, the guys were dressed in these suits. Looked like they were made out of the foreskins of llamas. And I'm just looking around. I mean, I've never seen such expensively dressed people. So when I got up, I said, "Hey, Charlotte, this is what casual looks like." I didn't realize I was walking into Charlotte casual. It was something else. And I instantly knew I was some of the richest men in North Carolina and married to the richest women. And I could see it just by walking to the door. Mm-hmm. I was bushwhacked by it.
Mm-hmm. And beyond that, here you are, somebody who's a celebrity, let me step back on that. Not celebrity, but you've risen to the height in your field. Did you still feel awkward around that kind of
glitter? Yes, I certainly did. I always feel awkward. And my mother had a keen sense of social inferiority. And so my mother had a unique way of getting out of it. She came from... when I tell you my mother was from a redneck background, I want you to believe me. My mother was... So what she did, she married a Marine officer, and she simply lied the rest of her life about where she came from. And by the time she died, she was claiming that she had a degree from Agnes Scott in Atlanta, that we were descended from the largest plantation owner family in Alabama, and that we had plantations and grew cotton. And it was all just a lie, or at least I think it was a lie. But what I now think is my mother was the first fiction writer that ever came out of our family, and that she wrote her story before I wrote mine.
Now, is that what being a Southern writer is? Then?
Right.
Is that, no, truly, I mean, is that, I'm seriously asking, is that what, when your mom, you say your mom wanted you to be a Southern writer?
I think she willed me to be a writer.
Okay.
I think it was a
will. Who happened to be from the South?
And she was from the South. And Dad was from the North. He was from Chicago. So there was great geographical rivalry in there. The South is losers, Dad would say, you know. And Mom would rise up in the South's defense. And that was this little game that was played my whole childhood. Mom fought for the South, and all seven of her kids are fiercely, staunchly Southern.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Gene is with us from Raleigh. Hi there, Gene.
Hi there, Melinda. I want to... certainly welcome Mr. Conroy to the Triangle.
Thank you, Jim.
Congratulate him on his award. But I'd like to express a bit of appreciation for a book that's not so often talked about. I have to admit to being a little behind. I haven't read Lords of Discipline and Losing Season yet, so I got some catching up to do.
I can tell you the whole plot, Gene. Don't worry about
it. Well, I'm a real fan of the Lowcountry area, which, of course, you write a lot about. And in that book, Lords of Discipline, which, is about the Citadel, that prologue in there, which is a portrayal of Charleston and Charleston society, is one of the most devastatingly accurate things I have ever seen about that place, and I just enjoyed reading it immensely.
Well, I'm glad you did. So you'll know there is a... Thomas Wolfe in Lacombe and Angel also does a scene in Charleston, sets a scene in Charleston. And it was almost in homage to Thomas Wolfe that I wrote that prologue.
Ha. Huh. Well, I heard a story from a friend of ours once years ago who was visiting Charleston and said to this old grand dame, who was obviously from the right side of Broad Street, that he was eager to move to Charleston. And he thought when he got there, he was, one of the first things he wanted to do was join the St. Cecilia Society. And she sort of drew herself up to her full 60-inch height and said, "Young man, it is obvious that you are clearly not to the manner born."
That's Charleston.
Absolutely. But enjoy all your books, and good to hear that you're here.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for your call, Gene. Speaking of Thomas Wolfe, you're going to be getting that award tomorrow here at UNC, the Thomas Wolfe Award. You're working on a script?
I've been working on a script for, I think, 10 years.
Look Homeward Angel.
Look Homeward Angel. And I'm going to go back to when I get back home and try to finish it up and send it out to him. But it's a work of love.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would love to see the thing come to the screen.
So you're doing this on spec, right?
Yeah,
I mean, you're just
right now
writing it. Okay. How have you done scripts other than the one that you started to do for Prince of Tides?
I've done lots of scripts. Doug Marlette and I wrote a script called X a couple of years ago. And I got into it in that period of my life before I realized Hollywood would eat me alive if I stayed with it. And I wrote a script for The Prince of Tides. And I wrote a script, the first version of the script, for Beach Music. And then I said, enough. I could do this the rest of my life. Some of these people are horrible, carnivorous people, and I need to get back to writing the books I think I was born to write.
Mm-hmm. The Losing Season wouldn't have prepared you for Hollywood then?
Even my Losing Season did not prepare me for Hollywood. I was simply stunned by the ferocity of the people I met out there.
Really? In My Losing Season, you write that it was during that season that you decided, yeah, you're going to go and do what your mom had been grooming you for, and that was to become a writer. And we came up with something that we'd like to play.
Oh, no.
We'd like to play.
Okay.
You wrote about this in My Losing Season. Let's hear a little bit of this.
I haven't heard it since that night.
So set us up for this. This is.
It was after a baseball game at University of West Virginia, and we always travel with these station wagons. And we were coming out of the hills of West Virginia, and we were by this beautiful river. And all the guys were asleep, and two songs came on. The one you just played, and Monday by the Mamas and the Papas. Mm-hmm. The songs came on, and I was in kind of a reverie in the back seat. It was so beautiful. And this river was so beautiful. And the moon, when we were coming out of the mountains, and that is when I made a promise to myself that I was going to try to become a writer. Didn't know how to do it. Didn't know how to become one. Didn't know one. But I was going to do it.
Because you heard Sarah Vaughan singing.
It was so beautiful. And I haven't heard it since that night.
Is that right?
I haven't heard it.
Is that right?
And I wasn't sure it was Sarah Vaughan. You know, at that time in my life, I knew nothing about music. But I heard that song, and it was so achingly beautiful, followed immediately by the first time I ever heard Monday. And I said, okay, I've got to at least say I'm going to do it and see if I can do it. And I started calling myself a writer that night, and I never stopped.
Okay. Pat Conroy is with us, and I think we have time for at least one more call. Jordan joins us now from Chapel Hill. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm a teacher at a local independent school, and I teach a film class, and we are just studying the screenplay to The Great Santini and the transfer of the novel to the screen. And my question for Pat was, what decisions went into what stayed in the screenplay and what was cut from the novel? I know he's talked a little bit about how carnivorous Hollywood is, and we certainly have talked a little bit about that in my class, but I'm just curious as to about some of those decisions.
But that is a fabulous movie. I love that movie. And I got to tell you, kids, I got to see that movie with my father for the first time.
Uh-huh.
And my favorite scene in my entire life was when they were burying the great Santini. I look over, and there are tears rolling down my father's cheeks, moved to tears by his own demise. And I said, give me a break. The scene that did not make it in the movie that I would love to have been there is when they're coming into the town and the sister Marianne is catching her tears in a spoon and flinging them at the father. I would love for that scene to have been made the final cut. But I love that movie. And it's the only place in the world I can go to see my mother alive. They let her be in the scene during the basketball game. She's sitting directly behind Blythe Danner. And so we go back to when the family gets together, we turn that thing on and go right to that scene, just look at Mom being happy.
Right. Pat Conroy is our guest today on The State of Things. Was that your favorite movie adaptation?
Yes. Okay. You know, I really liked that movie. Mm-hmm. And it was magic. It was made in Beaufort mm-hmm. and filmed in Beaufort, the town I'd written about.
Pat Conroy has been our guest today on The State of Things. Thanks for being with us, and congratulations on the Thomas Wolfe Award.
Thank you for congratulating me. It was one of the great moments of my life.
Pat Conroy will be giving a public lecture tomorrow at 7:30 at Hill Hall at the UNC Chapel Hill campus. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Melinda Pencava.